Thanks, Roy. Really appreciate that introduction. Thank you to Adam, Lily, and the team at the entire Open Banking Expo team. They've been instrumental and continue to push the cause of open banking in Canada. And thank you to everybody that's taken time out of your valuable day to be here this afternoon and listen to the perspectives of my colleagues and I, kind of consolidating into a single view about how EQ Bank thinks about this important topic. I divided my remarks here into three parts. Part one is an assessment of where Canada currently stands in the quest to modernize its financial system through open banking. Part two is more of a philosophical argument about how open banking fits into the advancement of democratic societies. And part three attempts to set our thoughts on what we need to do next to bring open banking home in a made in Canada solution. To get right to part one, I'll have to say it's a pleasure to be with you, even though I'm not pleased to admit that so far the story of open banking on our country is a little like the story of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Is that the Maple Leafs fans complaining, or is that the open banking fans complaining? So while other players like the UK, France, Germany, Australia continue to shoot and score, Canada keeps tripping on the blue line and failing to move the agenda forward at anything like a reasonable pace. This inertia is embarrassing for our country. The belabored process is a lost opportunity and a drag on our economy that hurts everyone. We've been talking about open banking as a necessity for years, and spectators probably assume that we're ragging the puck, a great tactic for killing a penalty, but a lousy approach to building a better, more equitable society with consumer rights and freedoms, the centerpiece of a growing economy. As part of our efforts to bring attention to open banking and financial modernization generally, EQ Bank created this Venn diagram 5 years ago for our submission to the Advisory Committee on Open Banking. I think it's fair to say we've seen very little real progress since on the main items. Take digital identity. We all know the value of digital IDs as an enabling tool for open banking, a tool that would keep Canadians safe through robust authentication and make services of all sorts, not just banking, easier and faster to attain. Even so, we're no closer to the creation of digital IDs in Canada than when we published this diagram. Yes, we have workarounds and substitutes like the selfie ID using informed artificial intelligence, which EQ Bank began to deploy last year to reduce friction in digital account openings. But in this file, we are surely falling far behind countries like Estonia and India. Surely we can do better to create a federated model that links national and provincial identity management systems in a central digital ID system. That doesn't even appear to be the direction we're heading in, and it's more than a shame. If the Digital ID and Authentication Council of Canada, or DIAC, estimates are accurate, the potential value that trusted digital identity could bring to Canada is in excess of 1% of GDP, a big number. We all know that secure open banking can also improve access for business owners by simplifying their onboarding processes, accelerating KYC activities that financial institutions must undertake under anti-money laundering or AML legislation. That's why the Venn diagram included this kind of KYC concept component, which we envisioned would be substantially aided in an open banking world by the creation of a central business registry for beneficial ownership. Such a registry would substantially reduce the complexity, paperwork, and costs for small business owners to open accounts, better enable banks to comply with anti-money laundering requirements, and help to curb a crime that is said to push $113 billion a year through Canada's financial and real estate systems every year. A crime that's so prevalent that in Canada we've come to know it as snow washing, puncturing our image as good global citizens. When we put the diagram together, we were optimistic that such a registry was on its way because provincial finance ministers and the federal government had signed a so-called agreement to strengthen beneficial ownership. That was in 2017. Once again, our optimism was misguided. 6 years later, we are still operating without a national beneficiary registry. Legitimate small businesses are still unfairly burdened, and money launderers still operate successfully in the shadows, even though financial institutions, including our own, expend enormous resources to fulfill their AML obligations. It's a terrible picture. What we do see developing is a set of independent registries. The Government of Canada promised to launch its own by the year end, that it'll only cover federally regulated entities and apparently won't even cover your real estate. To its credit, Quebec recently launched its RAQ system. And perhaps by 2025, BC will stand up its transparency registry. These are a far cry from the robust, standardized systems that Canada really needs. For example, Quebec's registry offers a great deal of information on businesses and their controlling parties, but ownership of control is often exercised through holding companies or trusts. And they're only required to register if they actually operate in Quebec. This creates an information gap. Who knows what elements may be missing from other future registries, when and if they finally come to the table on their own terms. While our federal provincial system has given Canada so many strengths, it's failing in terms of allowing us to create value, employment-creating activities in small business community in particular, and to individuals in Canada more generally. Next, the real-time rail. Frankly, it's off the rails 6 years after Payments Canada delivered its published its delivery roadmap. Last October, RTR's introduction was delayed again as Payments Canada announced it needed more time to validate and test the system's components and end-to-end integration. So far, there is no clear view of when or even if RTR will launch. Given the time and effort expended to date, this is enormously disappointing. It's holding our economy back and making life difficult for all of us. Just last week, I had to make a payment modestly above Interac e-transfer limits and found myself bizarrely writing a check, putting it in the mail, all in an effort to save a $50 service charge for a wire. That would not happen in an RTR world. And then to open banking. Our country has been discussing, studying, and debating it for years. On the bright side, we know the policy objectives of the Bank of Canada and the Department of Finance are aligned with the need for open banking, digital ID, and payments modernization. We know that Bill C-27, the government's Digital Charter Implementation Act, that could enable new consumer privacy, personal information and data protection, and artificial and data intelligence and data acts is with Parliament's Standing Committee on Industry and Technology. We know firsthand, even this morning, from Abraham Tachihan, Canada's open banking lead, that he's actively working with the Open Banking Secretariat, as well as external experts, and we anxiously await his report. And frankly, we're going to miss him when he steps down in September. We also know that the logic of true open banking is irrefutable and that other countries have embraced it successfully. However, I'm concerned, and from what I hear and what I read, that Canada may be stumbling, zombie-like, into a form of data sharing that may purport to be open banking, but in reality is an outcome of a mishmash of individual players setting their own agendas. We may get lucky with that approach, but surely success using it is hardly assured. To apportion blame is not my purpose, and I'll admit, frankly, I had a position as one of Canada's, a CEO of one of Canada's banks. I'll take my share of blame. I should have lobbied harder and done more to help Canadians understand the value of open banking. I take my responsibility and offer my mea culpa on that. We have not created a groundswell of public interest or demand that would give the impetus to this initiative. Stepping back, I thought long and hard about what I wanted to say that would correctly summarize the current situation for you. I consulted the Oxford Dictionary, Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the Cambridge Thesaurus, and the phrase that just kept coming to mind was clusterfuck. You'll see its military representation here, the letters C and F. Profanity isn't my style, so apologies if this offends, but what we have now is a bunch of unfinished business we have not handled well as an industry or a country. We desperately need to get on the same page. I'm hopeful we will, and my optimism has to be tempered by what we've seen so far. At the pace we're going, we're going to have an open banking proof of concept in place by mid-century. It hardly excites any of us with careers within the span of our careers. Now, no way should my remarks be seen as a criticism of well-intentioned and hard-working advisors, including Abraham. No doubt he's done his homework, and I look forward to seeing the accreditation framework, technical standards, and customer consent processes. However, for those of us who have been advocating for the better part of the last decade, it is supremely frustrating that we still do not have the rules of the road for industry participants to follow and no clear expectation on data standards, let alone the green light to actually start writing code to launch open banking capabilities. Canadians are being damaged by this lack of progress, and it stultifies our economy by making life and commerce harder and more expensive, especially for small business owners. Despite these musings, I remain unabashedly positive about Canada's future and the possibilities of Canadian financial modernization. Now to part two of my remarks. The philosophy that I believe underpins open banking and its intersection with a democratic society. To me, open banking is bigger than banking itself, and it is an ideal vehicle or launchpad to define the rights of Canadian citizens and obligations of corporations and government in a digital society. While open banking transcends banking, bankers themselves are in an incredibly powerful and influential position because they appreciate the value of the data that is the focus of open banking. And they have a massive head start in collecting that data and understanding that data. Throughout history, banks are a cornerstone of societal development, and we can track the evolutions of banks by the advancements of their own record keeping. Banking is thought to have begun as early as fourth millennium, so 4,000 BCE, before Common Era. In ancient Babylonia, temples were known to lend to farmers. The deposit was recorded on a clay tablet, and the farmer was given a receipt in the form of a clay token used to pay the fees to the temple. This is the very definition of hard data, and while difficult to share, it formed an indelible record. The Code of Hammurabi, it's a difficult one to pronounce, written on stone in around 1758, before Common Era, described the first regulation of banking activity. Rome's first emperor, Augustus, recognized the advantage of keeping detailed transaction records in his imperial account books, which allowed him to publicly boast of his personal wealth. But it wasn't really until the 13th century, with the invention of double-entry bookkeeping and the rigor necessary to control the economy, that banking took a major step forward. Double-entry was used by the Medicis to open branches in different locations, track investments, and transfer money across Europe using exchange notes that allowed it to dominate the financial world. Great for the Medicis, but a system that was inaccessible and incomprehensible to the common people of Renaissance Europe. The History of Banks, written by Richard Hildreth in 1837, chronicles the development of the banking system in England and the United States up to that point. Interestingly, Hildreth wrote that every branch of trade was a monopoly. The progress of knowledge has banished that wretched system from every sort of business, except for the business of banking. Before long, it will be obligated to surrender this, its last stronghold. I wonder what Hildreth would think of banking in the 21st century, the data monopolies enjoyed by the largest players, and the endless debates around data rights. Another big stink up in banking history was taken when banks started to computerize. In 1953, a Stanford Research Institute built the first bank mainframe to process checks for Bank of America. Thus began a new and unstoppable chapter. As Niall Ferguson, author of The Ascent of Money, observed, if the last four millennia has witnessed the ascent of man, the thinker, we now seem to be thinking through the ascent of man, the banker. Other early technology was used to keep account balances, record cash withdrawals, and clear checks. No records were really kept of what was spent, as most were anonymous cash transactions or checks that simply cleared with no record of the payee. As payment systems evolved, banks began to capture a record of the credit card transactions and debits of every customer. Shockingly, this evolution happened without a vigorous debate about who owned the underlying data. Even though I'm a banker, I will say without reservation that in every democracy, there absolutely should have been a public debate about the data rights associated with the records retained this way. When you think about it, today's digital records were effectively written by customers in the book of record maintained by the banks. You'd think the authors would have the full rights to the books they write. In Canada, this is not the case, and it's another reason why open banking, with consumer consent at its heart, is so important to our democracy and to our civil society. In fairness, it wasn't by design that records of customer transactions came out of the control of banks, but that is exactly what happened with computerization. At this point, I'll make an admission. I am a digital Republican. And I suspect the very fact that you're in the room today means you're one too. So as not to be confused with the American political party of the same name, I use the term Republican to describe political liberty defined by and for the people, free of arbitrary power. A digital Republican believes that digital technologies should be accountable to the people over whom they exert power and should be shaped according to people's values. True republicanism holds that freedom is lost whenever there is a systematic imbalance of power between two parties. Think of banks and their customer. Power is not shared, it's inherently asymmetric. Jamie Susskind, author of The Digital Republic on Freedom and Democracy in the 21st Century, has helped shape my worldview. If you have not read his book, I strongly suggest you do, as it wrestles with the question, how can freedom and democracy survive in a world of data collected and controlled by unaccountable forces in society? It's a masterwork that explores the intersection between politics, technology, the ideology of market individualism, and republicanism. It serves up as a wake-up call to society that needs to be jarred out of its current state of inertia to demand the democratization of technology. According to the author, digital power emanates from ownership and control of technology and is enabled by a blind-eye approach to legislative governance. These powers are exercised today by Silicon Valley heavyweights and big companies that can use algorithms to advance their economic interests. These powers are usually unchecked and largely ordered according to the logic of the market economy that encourages individualism, so the interest of individual banks, often at the expense of community advancement. As Susskind says, the problem isn't Mark Zuckerberg, it's the idea of Mark Zuckerberg and all the other Zuckerbergs out there still to come who have the power to make decisions about our collective fate with impunity. One could say the very same and perhaps more about Elon Musk. It's not whether you agree or disagree or admire Musk. It's that he should not have the unchecked authority to control the Twitter narrative. Today, digital power does not reside in Parliament. It operates outside the traditional channels of politics, and that should be a siren call for all of us to do something about it. Similarly, it's not necessarily how banks use the data they hold that deeply offends me as a digital Republican. It's more the fact that they alone get to decide how it's used as the creators of that data. The open banking movement, in my mind, is essentially about creating an appropriate balance of power between the customers of banks and the banks as repositories of data. You can see why it's vital for Canada to adopt a system that considers the broader interests of society, interests that go well beyond those that might be addressed using a market-driven approach. For solutions, the Digital Republic posits that society is owed a duty of openness and transparency from those who create digital technology so that concerned citizens and regulators know whether technology is compliant with the law and decisions made by bots can be reasonably challenged. There remains plenty of work to be done to define and enshrine our rights as citizens in a digital society, and time is not something we can afford to waste. Technology, including artificial intelligence, does not sleep, eat, or get into turf wars. Every day that we do not act puts us further behind as a society. Now for the final part of our remarks and the thoughts forward on the route forward for Canada. Looking ahead, and despite the frustration I feel about the slow pace of progress so far, I have no doubt we will get to open banking and faster payments and digital identity for that matter. How and when we get there is really the question. In a concentrated banking system like Canada's, a market solution, one grounded in maximizing shareholder value, is unlikely to provide the optimal outcome for freedom and choice for consumers. Instead, the route forward should be established as part of a democratic process. The CEO of Canada's Challenger Bank, who believes passionately in the value of competition, saying that competition can't be counted on to get to the right answer is really quite the admission. A simple example of why the market can provide peculiar outcomes lies in the evolution of the Interac e-transfer system. It may surprise some of you to know that Canada's largest banks pay a marginal cost of 6 cents per Interac e-transfer, while smaller banks, like my own, pay 43 cents for the very same transaction. How is a small bank supposed to compete when they pay seven times more than their rivals with what is effectively a monopolistic payment system? Well, clearly I have a self-interest in this issue as CEO of EQ, you know, in terms of looking after the interests of EQ Bank's shareholders. The broader concern is it damages consumers who pay higher fees due to a less competitive banking system. Similar inequitable outcomes could occur with open banking if the future is defined by narrow groups of stakeholders. Much as it's objectionable to many that Mark Zuckerberg gets to define what happens on social media, I find it fundamentally objectionable to have banks define the parameters of open banking in an unfettered manner. Banks for sure need to be, and frankly are willing to be, at the table with other stakeholders to deliver a common good for our society, but they should be just one voice. You may wonder why I'm so keen to see open banking raise the industry's competitive intensity in ways that will lead to lower fees and better savings rate. I've long taken a somewhat contrarian position because I think it's right for our country and right for Canadians to have a truly open and competitive system that allows them to build their wealth. Real competition and choice and new approaches to all manner of retail and small business banking services are what Canadians deserve. In the same breath, I will say that Canadian banks as a whole will continue to nation build just as they have since the founding of the nation, even in a future defined by open banking. To my fellow Canadian bankers who are concerned about the future of self-directed finance, remember, you know your customers so much better than anyone else. You know their financial habits, their status, and that head start will continue to give you enormous advantage. True, you're going to have to contend with greater competition. But you can take solace from this open banking fact. Banks in countries where consumer-directed finance is already a reality continue to generate good returns for their shareholders while doing what Richard Hildreth, advocate in the history of banks in 1837, to put the public advantage principally in view. I recall reading a quote from a representative of one of the UK's largest banks a year after open banking became a reality there. He said that open banking allowed his institution to get more consumer credit data, which in turn allowed them to materially increase its lending business. To me, that's an important admission that it illustrates the virtuous growth potential of better open data sharing for both consumers and the financial institutions trying to serve them. By promoting the merits of open banking and developing new ways of servicing their customers using enhanced capabilities, Canadian banks will improve their standing with the public and receive stronger social license to move forward. Open banking is obviously the right thing for our society, for consumers and for small business. Policymakers recognize it and have committed to developing a Made in Canada regime. So let's get this show on the road, and let's not allow perfect to be the enemy of good. We will find the right road, even if there are some misturns along the way. And let's get fully behind Abraham's report when it comes out. Even if it doesn't have everything everyone wants, we should make it a catalyst for action and the fuse that ignites the political will to prioritize open banking. I do hear some rumblings from some quarters who believe that the report will not have political backing and therefore can be safely ignored. It seems to me that's entirely the wrong way to think about it. And what we should be doing is think about it as a group and see it as a roadmap to get us working together to deliver on the open banking agenda. We can ensure that all banks bring pens up for a new era, and in so doing, create a modern financial system that helps Canadian productivity. Certainly, you have the constituencies that you can influence, whether in your own bank, in business, or in the public service. Let's use that influence to lean in, awaken, and urgently move forward. To sum up, we should seize this opportunity to take the next step to becoming an advanced, pluralistic country that is a truly inclusive, sustainable, open banking system that works for everyone, including new immigrants and indigenous peoples, many of whom are disadvantaged by the system we operate today. We should seize this opportunity now. As bankers, technologists, and as Canadians, we owe it to ourselves, to our economy, and to our democracy to become a modern, digitally enabled open banking country. It does seem to me that we have the people in the industry ready to do that, And we're able to deliver on an ambitious agenda to make that happen. Thank you for investing the time to hear our perspective, the perspective of EQ Bank and my colleagues. We understand that your time is valuable and hope you feel that at least one nugget of my thought in my comments was worth it. Enjoy the rest of the conference.